It's episode two time. This episode is going to be a bit of a doozy, so grab your snacks, light a calming candle, whatever you need, because remember how I said the cops interviewed were trash? Yeah, they show us why this episode. So last episode ended with Terry being arrested, and they're now announcing that arrest via press conference. So McNeely says that Terry said Sean went into the store, came out, saw Mulligan was sleeping, and decided he wanted his gun. Now this is a plainclothes officer in his regular vehicle sleeping. How would they know he's a cop and that he would have a service weapon on him? Also, when asked if the shots came from inside the car, they claim Patterson said no, that the shots were from outside the car through the small crack in the window. I'm going to post a photo of it on Instagram so you can see, but there's no way this could have happened based on the evidence we got in episode one. We clearly saw shell casings on the passenger side of the car, so how could this have happened if he was outside of the car? Right before I moved out on my own, my stepfather and step-grandfather took me to the shooting range to learn to shoot as a method of self-defense. From that experience, I firmly recall shell casings ejecting toward me, which was not my jam at all. So, armed with that baby knowledge, how exactly would casings get all the way on the passenger side of the car? The first two in that crack between the floor mat and the door, and the other in that obscure space by the seatbelt thingamabob. Like my use of technical terms here on the pod, huh? But also, remember that Mulligan was shot once up the nose. How would he have been able to do that through that small crack in the window? That's some serious double-jointed Cirque du Soleil type action the detectives are asking us to believe here. David, Sean's uncle, comes over and he tells him, you know, you need to protect yourself because Terry is going to involve you. Sean didn't care because he knew the truth. He knew that he went to buy Pampers and that's all. He even has a receipt from 3:01 a.m. showing he bought the diapers. The 911 call came in at 3:49 a.m. and the suspected time of death is 3:40 a.m. So they're saying Sean waited for over 35 minutes?
They think this piece of physical evidence that puts him at the crime scene. It's the wrong time. It doesn't fit their timeline. He has no connection to Mulligan whatsoever. All of their initial leads that they had all have to be completely disregarded in order for them to start focusing on Sean. And that's essentially what they do. They abandon everything that they thought was happening about the case. That is the single event, his recitation of that event to the police, that affected the next 25 years of his life.
So Sean introduces us to some people that he used to hang out with, including the friend who gave him his nickname Stutta. As what happens in poor neighborhoods, the young men turn to selling drugs to help make ends meet with their parents.
But we were on the streets. We just got too old for Nintendo and Atari, man. We used to have fun too, man. You know what I mean? Like I told you, man. It wasn't always bad, but then it was just drugs are here. This is how you make money. Boom. Whoa, I'm gonna try this out. You know, it was like, hey, it was there, so hey, it was not part of our environment. So, hey, I tell you, crack man did a bad thing around here, man.
I tried to get a job. I remember going to the Dedham Mall trying to fill out applications. Never got a call back. How am I gonna get money? My mother's on drugs. I need school clothes. And how am I gonna get my school clothes if my mom's dealing with a chemical dependency and my pops is not around?
I was only 14, so I had to do what I had to do to take care of my brother and my mother. So what do you want us to do? You only leave us one choice. We got to survive out here.
And that's when a lot of that gunplay started coming in, you know. But we thought we was in the Wild West, you know. Everybody had to have a gun, so.
Because of this lifestyle, obviously they were known to law enforcement. Bill Stewart, who was an assistant chief probation officer at the time, knew him because of his involvement with some other kids. He says that the rumor on the street was that Sean and Terry did it. Again, why? He already had a gun, so you shoot Mulligan with your own gun simply because you want his gun? This isn't really making sense for me. This square isn't circling for me the way that they want it to. It's October 9th, 13 days after the murder, and Terry Patterson is being arraigned. The district attorney says they can't tell the press what led them to Patterson, but that circumstances led them that way. What circumstances? I wish I could know, but Bratton says that they feel they filled in the Y gaps, and considering he felt it was premeditated, the Y gaps aren't really filling in for me. So if he could give us a little bit of information on that, maybe he could help me out, but the gaps seem pretty open to me. Sean notices a police presence following him around October the 2nd. His mind wasn't on Mulligan at the time, so he wasn't sure why they were following him. His mom called a lawyer friend who referred them to Norman Zelkin and David Duncan. Sean told them that the cops were following him, and even though he was at their office, they followed him there as well. Norman and David looked outside and saw that there was a very large police presence outside of their offices. And because of that, they knew that they weren't just following Sean. They were planning on arresting Sean. They instructed Sean to not talk to anyone, and that if the cops arrested him, to let them know that he had lawyers, and that was the extent of the conversation he was to have with them. It's the 6th, 10 days after Mulligan's murder, and Sean is attending his cousin's funeral. Sean's girlfriend and partner, Latia Walker, knew it wasn't going to be a good day. Not just because there were cops everywhere when they arrived, but that it was also a funeral for two women. It was also an open casket funeral. So when Sean saw the state of Celine, who had fought, he lost it. Celine and Sean grew up together, so they were really close. He was like her protector. So seeing her that way, he just couldn't handle it. After the funeral, they went to the burial site, and it was a hard time, made worse by the cop presence and helicopter flying overhead. Zero respect for what the family was going through. This is a double murder, and cops are just around, not caring. To top it all off, they arrest him there. We see some press footage of this arrest, and we see that Sean had his head down, which his lawyer Zelkin says he would have advised him to keep it up because he was innocent and he didn't want him to look guilty, but rather to show a face of innocence. And keeping his head down may make people think that he was guilty. Rosemary notes that the cops had to have notified the press that they were going to arrest Sean because there is no way the press would have been there. They wanted to make sure his face had been on the news and that they could say that he was arrested and that they did their job. Kevin Cullen, columnist for The Globe, remembers being struck by their ages and how they couldn't have been in the game long enough to be that cold. Not that he felt they didn't do it, but just that they were really young. Sean sees Terry in the courtroom, and he says that Terry told him he never told them that Sean did it. Considering what we saw in episode 1 and Terry's lawyer saying that she also didn't see him say yes, that Sean did it, we know that Terry is definitely telling the truth here.
When those two black kids got arrested, it's like, whoa, where'd that come from? Because everything was pointing to, you know, an execution style killing. And, you know, why would these two kids, you know, execute a cop in front of a store that's open 24 hours a day? It didn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, but, you know, anything's possible. It's possible. But my thought was, oh, God, here we go again. Here we go again. Are we doing another Carol Stewart? What's going on here?
The Carol Stewart case took place on October the 23rd, 1989. A woman is found shot in her car along with her husband, Chuck Stewart. Chuck calls 911, reporting that they had both been shot, but that she had been shot in the head. Adrian Walker, columnist with The Globe, tells us that a shocking murder happened in Mission Hill of a woman leaving a birthing class. Philip Martin, senior investigative reporter for WGBH News, remembers the case well. A young couple drove around Mission Hill, wife was shot, and husband was injured. Chuck gave a description of a black male with a raspy voice and black running suit with red stripes. Once he gave a description, they immediately start stopping black men all over the place. Tony describes the response as an armed invasion that tore places apart. Walker remembers how it broke along racial lines quickly, with a pretty much all-white police force going door to door in a black neighborhood with a narrative of a black person doing a terrible thing to this pregnant suburban white woman. Now, I'm no detective and I don't play one on TV, but I have seen enough TV to know that typically when it's a domestic case, normally the husband is the suspect. But here, they just immediately took the husband's word for it. He said a black man did it. So, a black man, they set out to arrest.
All the blacks sin. Yeah, they stop me in the street and they push me against the wall just because I'm black. Well, were the police aggressive? Yeah, they probably were. But as far as them abusing them and all that.
Walker says the people claiming it didn't happen, like Dwyer just was there, have zero credibility. The people in the spaces at that time, they saw it happen and they remember watching it. Willie Bennett ends up getting arrested. McNeely says that Willie was well known to the police because he had apparently shot a cop before.
They were just looking for someone to pin this murder on. And I think all black people in this city practically felt that way and felt it in a really visceral way right from the beginning. The white cops were going to go find some black guy to accuse of this murder. And if he did it, great. And if he didn't, maybe that was okay too.
They're getting ready to indict Willie Bennett. And Chuck Stewart's brother, Matthew Stewart, hears about the lineup and he identified him. Well, apparently he had guilty conscience, couldn't stand, so he comes back and he tells, I gotta tell the truth here.
What truth is that, you might be asking? It's that Chuck Stewart actually is the one who murdered his wife, not Willie Bennett, who they were getting ready to indict for the murder, but him. Not some black man with a raspy voice in a black running suit with red stripes, but the white husband. Had his brother not gotten cold feet, they would have gone forward with pinning the murder on Bennett. Neither Dwyer nor McNeely see any issue with how this case was done. McNeely even says, pretty flippantly, what were we supposed to do? He said that the perpetrator was black. Were we supposed to look for someone purple? No, you were supposed to do your job. Because there was no robbery aspect to this, no carjacking aspect to this. The window didn't appear to be down. So exactly what happened here? Nothing hear other than the word of Chuck Stewart, who ends up jumping from a bridge to avoid arrest for killing his wife in an insurance fraud scheme. Only he is the one who pointed to a black person. And instead of investigating and investigating him, you just start knocking, well, not even knocking, you just start tearing down doors in black neighborhoods looking for someone. That's not okay. And it really points to a much larger situation that these cops can't even admit their fault in this case. This easy case that they could just say, you know what? We messed up. We were wrong. No, they found an excuse. Well, he said, so that's what we did. Is Chuck the police officer or are you?
Chuck Stewart knew that he might get away with this by blaming a black man. And in the Boston police just ate it up. It revealed the ugly side of America, and not just Boston, but Boston in particular, and that is racism.
So after this case, the district attorney, Norman Flanagan, who was white, unexpectedly retires, giving Ralph Martin the job. Martin was a black attorney who, as McNeely says, came with the baggage that Boston cops didn't get persecuted in the Stewart case, which obviously didn't sit well with said cops, including Dwyer. So there was built-in tension when he came in. In 1992, Martin comes in and makes some changes, angering people, especially Dwyer.
You know, the DAs and the police commissioners worked together pretty closely. I think he was one of the first DAs who really believed it should be sort of an adversarial or at least an arm's length relationship. And there was always a lot of tension between the district attorney's office and the Boston Police Department. He was skeptical of a lot of police officers, and he never made any secret of it.
Ralph Martin decides he's going to have detectives from homicide transferred out. So I was one of them. Eddie tried to negotiate, so that became an issue where I had kind of a war. I frequently have a lot of bad things to say about Ralph Martin. I don't like him. I just think he's a punk.
A punk, huh? McNeely felt Martin got caught up in trying to be the salvation for all the wrongs done in the Stewart case. The salvation. We know exactly what he means. He's saying the salvation to the black community, putting a black man in charge, and now they're going to rip apart this white department who did this thing in the Stewart case, and things are going to change. They don't, as a spoiler alert. Because Flanagan allowed the department to do whatever they wanted for decades, and now you have this new guy coming in wanting to change that. Tony tells us that 2 years wasn't enough to change the culture of the department. So the same culture and people that were present during the Stewart case were still there during the Mulligan case. As expected, Martin fell in line with the police union and became an utter disappointment. William Dwyer states that Sean and Terry, whose first name he didn't care to remember, claims that they killed Mulligan to have his weapon as a trophy. Except, to have something as a trophy, you have to actually have said weapon and show it off to people. That didn't happen. McNeely says that Brazel developed a relationship with Sean's uncle, and based on that relationship, he was told the gun might be in a field. So, armed with that information, on the 5th of October, they do a second statement with David Murray. Murray had been incarcerated for mass robbery and was out on probation at the time of his statements, so he claims that they used that against him. So, to save himself, he decided to tell Brazel that Sean and Terry buried the guns. On October the 7th, they go searching for them in a vacant lot by his house. There, they find two guns, the murder weapon, and Mulligan's gun.
They find the murder weapon and Mulligan's Glock 9 in that field right across from Sean's house. The goal is, let's get as much physical evidence as we can to connect this kid to the crime, because we have to stop this investigation. And that's what they did. That's how Rosa Sanchez gets involved. Rosa Sanchez was the key to that case. She was the only one who said she could identify Sean under very, very suspicious circumstances. But she said she could identify Sean.
Now, Rosa makes a statement at 8:12 p.m. the night of the 26th. She claims to have arrived at the Walgreens at 3:05 a.m. and noticed a black male crouched next to Mulligan's car. He apparently looked at her really quickly and then looked down, according to her statement. Her second statement is taken on October 5th, and there she did a photo array and she picked Sean out of a lineup. October the 18th, she is asked to confirm her lineup identification. When Sean arrived at the lineup, there was a blank space that they had asked Sean to step in. Zelkin objects to the lineup, as not only has Sean's face been in the paper repeatedly, but he's one of two guys wearing white shirts. He asks them to move the numbers around because one of the investigators had left the room after Sean got into his spot and then came back. Pretty much understanding that the blank spot was intentional, they probably told Rosa which number Sean was in. They had him change from 5 to 6, and Rosa comes in. She picks out Sean. Now, during his turn, they switch up some language and take some pauses compared to the others, but this could be the way that they edited the video, so I'm not 100% sure of this. But Detectives Sarah and Robinson were involved in the lineup, and despite over 50 people on the case, Sarah and Robinson, as well as Brazel, were the only three that kept popping up over and over again on the most important parts. They got statements and found evidence no one else could find. So, how is that? I guess we'll have to find out in the next episode. And with that, episode 2 is down and 6 more to go. In the next episode, we get a look at Sean's first 3 trials and find out a bit more about Rosa, including her relationship to one of the detectives in this case. Thanks so much for listening, and see you in the next episode.